You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm once again joined by my friends Julie. Hey, Julie.
Hi.
And Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hi there.
And today, I mean, obviously we will be talking about Damn Fine Cups of Culture. More specifically, we will be talking about cinema. But we will be talking about one aspect of cinema that so far we actually haven't talked about all that much. Imagine yourself at a movie theater, especially for those of you who haven't been at a movie theater for quite a while now. Imagine the lights going down, the curtains opening, and basically the first thing that you hear is probably something like the 20th Century Fox fanfare, the Universal Studios tune. You hear an orchestra. I mean, obviously, realistically, you hear the ads trying to sell you ice cream and cars and possibly cigarettes, depending on where you live. But the thing that we go to the cinema for is, I think, encapsulated in the music. So that's what we will be talking about today. Music in the movies, movie soundtracks, and especially those big movie soundtracks played by big orchestras that we all love so much. So let's perhaps start with Sam. You want to tell us a bit about what your feelings are about movie soundtracks?
Well, this is very exciting because preparing for this podcast, I realized that soundtracks are my original gateway into cinema. I started with music, and I think my love for cinema started because of the music and not the other way around. So that was when I first heard soundtrack music. I didn't even know what it was, but it got me straight away into this cinematic universe of imagining the scene that could go along with it. And then later on, I would see those scenes in the movie. And of course, that was my gateway passion, and started with composers and collecting soundtrack CDs and watching more and more movies because of the music. So for me, it's very exciting that we talk about that relationship, because in a way, for me, the music was always at the center, and I'm still a huge soundtrack collector and fan.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar. What about you, Julie?
So when I was a little girl, the first movie music that I grew up with were Disney songs. I'm not going to count those here, but with children's films already, you can see that it's such an integral part of the movie experience, right? Who hasn't heard little girls scream out Frozen in the tram or something? I mean, I think we can all feel it from a very young age that this is something that we respond to, I think, as human beings from the point that you were very, very young.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just little girls and Frozen, I'm pretty sure. While I probably didn't scream it out in a tram, as a kid, I definitely very often kind of sang the Star Wars fanfare or the Imperial March, stuff like that. I also think that there's a very immediate, very emotional access to the movies that comes with music, more so than with words, because words are something much more cognitive, I think, and music goes straight to the gut very often. Let's perhaps make this more concrete. Sam, you mentioned that music was your gateway drug to cinema, and which films, which movie soundtracks, which composers were your gateway drug specifically?
There was this cassette of my grandfather's that I listened to, and there were two tunes on it in a row that I immediately loved. One was dramatic and bold, and the other one was lyrical and had a grand kind of opera style voice. And only later on did I find out that was Morricone's Once Upon a Time in the West, you know, Man with a Harmonica and Chill's theme. And those were really my two tunes that I listened to over and over again, and only much later saw the film too. And they had already grown in my mind so much, which is interesting because, of course, if you know that Morricone wrote them before the scenes were filmed and the music was played on set, then that makes absolute sense that I got into film music because of Morricone and that film.
And that's so lovely, because I remember when I was either with my dad alone or with my uncles, one of the first things that I distinctly remember about movie music, and I must have been about 10 or 11, was that Once Upon a Time was on the TV. And my uncle said, come on, come on, you have to see this film. This is a great film. Now, my mom wasn't there. Otherwise, she would have said, I don't think so. This is a girl who's 10 years old. And then the tune of The Man with the Harmonica, right? That sort of wail into the distance. That was, I think, the first time that I understood that this was a way of storytelling. Apart, of course, from the Disney songs. But this was something that was integral in a way to the film that I hadn't experienced before. So it's so lovely, Sam, that you and I, in our different ways, have the same seminal experience that Morricone drew us into movie music as an art of storytelling, right? I think that's so cool.
I'm not at all surprised, you know, that we share this passion as well. How about you, Matt?
I think with me, basically, my first movie soundtrack love was probably John Williams. I mean, I mentioned Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T. I mean, probably of all of those, E.T. was the first one I saw. And I think the music with Spielberg and John Williams, those are intertwined. I think the two of them, they worked so well with each other, especially in the 70s and 80s. Also Jaws, obviously, stuff like that. The iconic movie soundtracks, the ones that I think even people who don't know the films immediately know the soundtracks. That's definitely there with John Williams. I think it's also there with Morricone. I mean, go to any kind of place with lots and lots of people and you go, why, ya, ya, and people will respond, whether they've seen the films or not. So I think it's really those 70s, 80s big iconic soundtracks, but then also stuff like, you know, Rocky, Gonna Fly Now, these anthems almost. I always kind of think of these soundtracks a bit like, you know, Prokofiev, Peter and the Wolf, where each of the animals, each of the characters has their own tune, their own instruments, their own feel. And you hear it and you know, that's the wolf, that's the duck, that's the cat. And you have the same thing here, I think. You know, you hear Danny Elfman's Batman theme and you think, that's Batman. Star Trek, whether it's the TV series or the motion picture, you have very much these iconic tunes. In some ways, almost more with TV, because with TV, you had it every week. You had the same tune and it became part of the characters. But obviously, with movie series, the same thing. And there's so many of them. There's Elmer Bernstein, The March for the Great Escape, which I think any Brit of a certain age has it in their DNA. I think you can probably literally see that under a microscope. Or Maurice Charles, Lawrence of Arabia. Nino Rota, obviously, The Godfather. But then also people like Joe Hisaishi, who wrote so much for Studio Ghibli. I have to say, though, and this is now a bit of a kind of butt coming in, I used to love these big soundtracks, but I kind of have tired of them. I think part of that is that the best of them were really in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And I think since 2000, I think probably since Lord of the Rings, there haven't been any of these big, iconic orchestral soundtracks. Or possibly I've just moved away from that kind of film. I have to say that by now, I almost sometimes find it a bit pandering. You know, they're trying to tell you how to feel about a certain thing. And sometimes I have to say that's a bit too much for me. I still love them in the old films, but in new films, I actually like my soundtracks almost to be a bit more invisible.
Well, there was the beautiful Joker soundtrack. I mean, Joker was not a particular favorite of mine movie-wise. I didn't really see what all the fuss was about. But the soundtrack was absolutely gorgeous and really in sort of the very classic vein, right? I thought that was a very beautiful, very modern take on big orchestral scores. That's just one example. In this case, I think the soundtrack is much better than the movie, by the way, but okay.
I can totally see that. I think it's difficult to go anywhere from what John Williams has done in the past, for instance, or what those big composers of the 60s, 70s and beyond have done. And I think maybe it's difficult to come up with something new. So we feel that these types of orchestral scores are imitations of what has gone before. They're not really fresh and original. And I always feel there's this, you know, that the big dramatic, the bold statements, then there's the romantic or neo-romantic statements. And there might be a little bit of a synth Hans Zimmer type soundtrack today that kind of always sounds a little bit the same. Famously, the Zimmer sound is very repetitive and sometimes it works really well, works beautifully in, you know, Inception or Interstellar. But then in other films, you feel, this is basically just the same thing we've heard before. So I would also say the Joker score was one of the few in the last couple of years that I felt stood out as being truly original and truly fresh in that sense. What I started doing with those composers is that I go away from the famous themes and maybe their most iconic scores to their more obscure ones, the early ones, the forgotten ones. And it's very rewarding. I've just listened to a couple of John Williams scores from the early 70s, his disaster movie scores, the earliest Eastwood film, The Iger Sanction, and also the last Hitchcock family plot that he scored. And that's hugely rewarding when you see where those composers came from and how they have developed towards Jaws and Star Wars and E.T. and so on. Especially with Williams lately, I've discovered more in their early careers.
Yeah, no, I can definitely share that. I mean, I'm also thinking that if I look at the CDs that I bought, you know, I'm from the generation that still bought CDs. I would say during the first 15, 20 years of me buying CDs, 2 out of 3 of the albums that I bought were movie soundtracks. And very often they were kind of John Williams or anything of that kind of sort. And I think if I started to fall out of love with the big orchestral movie soundtracks, it was probably around the Star Wars prequels, where I definitely felt that John Williams also, there were 1 or 2 good tunes, almost iconic tunes. But if you compare that to the early Star Wars films, where every single tune had this instant characterization of a scene, of a character, of a plot point, and it felt like somehow around 1995, 2000, people started, you know, saying, give me that John Williams feeling. And that's what they did. But it felt like a copy. It's very much, you have to have very much in computer games, where basically for a long time, everything was, you know, John Williams, James Horner, but just not as good because it was copies of that. It was pastiche. And sometimes it was good pastiche, but there was no new spark.
And tragically also, John Williams became a copy of himself, I think, because he scored so many sequels and similar movies. And I would also argue that since the mid-90s, his stuff has also, at least for the big blockbuster movies, become a rehash of what has been there before, that is not quite as good as during his high time in the early, late 70s, early 80s, I would argue.
To get back to really good soundtracks that we like, can a great soundtrack elevate a mediocre or even a bad film to something much better than that? And if so, do you have any examples? Julie, you've got a big smile on your face, so how about you start on this?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely it can. One of my favorite examples is Elevated to the Scaffold, which is a little French noir. The film is nice. It's interesting, mostly as a precursor to the sort of Breathless type, Nouvelle Vague type films. But the music, oh my gosh, the music. I mean, that is just something else. This is one of those, you pointed this out earlier, Matt, where the characters' hearts almost speak through the music. The city speaks through the music. The decor speaks through the music. The music speaks for the film. And now this is not a terrible film. I mean, you can see it. It's lovely. But I would suggest you just buy the Miles Davis album, with all the takes and retakes and retakes, so you can see how the music developed into this almost organic thing. This is one example. There's another of my very favorite examples. A decidedly mediocre movie that my listeners should not see is The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which is a very sort of dated, it's cutesy, dated movie, but it has a score, which is a violin concerto, an existing violin concerto by Miklos Rosa. Now, we touched upon Miklos Rosa very briefly in the Noir podcast. He also did the score for Double Indemnity. And this music, again, just buy the concerto because it's magic, but the film is just meh. <You know? laughs> So, and this was my gateway into, not entirely into Miklos Rosa, but it was so evocative that I almost started liking the film because the music was so good. But the film really is not all that great. And I'll get into the jazz scores a little bit more later, but this is a very obvious example for, it's a pretty good little proto film, but the score just elevates it beyond what it is.
What about you, Sam? Do you have any examples of bad or mediocre films made good by the soundtrack?
Well, if I might answer this question kind of the other way around, I think one of my favorite composers, Jerry Goldsmith, he scored so many mediocre to really bad films, but he almost made all of them so much better thanks to his scores. And you could take that from horror movies. I mean, I love Gremlins, the original, but the score is just so much better than the movie itself. There's a disaster movie that I recently wrote about, Cassandra Crossing, that is absolutely, I would say, the most rip-off example of a good disaster movie. But the score stands out because Jerry Goldsmith has this capacity of just elevating anything with his, you know, orchestral brass and the beautiful theme. So I think for me, it's almost like the Goldsmith touch raises everything, elevates everything to a higher level because he's able to somehow go into all these genres and is so multifaceted and can just adapt and create music that is iconic. I think Poltergeist, you recall the theme First Blood is so much better thanks to Jerry Goldsmith's action score. And there's dozens and dozens of examples of that. So for me, it's almost like when I see, I call them my big five, when I see Goldsmith and Barry, Morricone and Williams and Herman, the credits at the beginning, I'm already excited because I know it's going to be a great movie experience, even though the movie itself, beyond the music, might not be that good.
I think Jerry Goldsmith is also a good counterpoint in some ways to John Williams, because a John Williams score you always recognize. You know, I think John Williams very much has a John Williams sound. Jerry Goldsmith, I think, is a much more adaptable composer, or was. If you listen, for instance, to his soundtrack for Alien, which is fantastic, very, very, very good. And you wouldn't recognize that it's the same guy who did the music for Star Trek The Motion Picture. So you've got two completely different acoustic worlds, and both of them, I think, perfect for the films. I have to say that one of the Jerry Goldsmith soundtracks that I really, really like is for Psycho 2. Now, if you hear Psycho 2, most people will just say, well, you know, you can't follow up on Psycho, neither the film nor the soundtrack. But I think both the film is better than you'd expect, and the soundtrack is beautiful. It immediately establishes Psycho 2 as a very different beast from Psycho 1, and the music, I think, does a great job there. It's one of those soundtracks that every now and then I think of it, even though I saw the film probably when I was 16 or 17, but I still think of the soundtrack and the emotions that it evoked. Another soundtrack where I think the film isn't really great, but the soundtrack makes it much better than it is A Man Called Nobody, where Morricone also did the soundtrack. And I think it's such a beautiful earworm, and a horrible earworm, because if you watch the film and you listen to the music, you're going to have that music in your head for the next 2 weeks. But hey, if you've got music in your head, it's better than it's something like that, wouldn't you say?
And if I may add about Jerry Goldsmith, he's even able to improve on his sequel soundtracks. So, you know, when he scores the sequels for First Blood, or when he scores the sequel for The Omen, he makes a different take on number 2 and number 3. So they sound similar in the main themes, but then he creates something completely differently sounding. So that's what I find amazing, even for movies that are worse than the original. The original wasn't even good. He makes better soundtracks. So that's probably the best that a composer can do, right?
Absolutely. Now, there's obviously also a different kind of movie soundtracks. We now talked about the big orchestral movie soundtracks that were composed specifically for those films. But a lot of films obviously also use music that already existed, very often songs, but also sometimes orchestral stuff, classical music. How do you feel about those? Do you see them the same way? Do they evoke the same emotions in you? Or are they a completely different beast as far as you're concerned? Perhaps I can start for a change. I would say that the king of this, obviously, is Quentin Tarantino. I think there's no doubt for me about that, that no one does the mixtape kind of soundtrack as well as him. And what I find fascinating about him is very often if you've got pre-existing music in films, you carry over the emotions that the music had in these different contexts, sometimes to very bad effect. I think, for instance, documentaries very often use pre-existing movie music. And if I watch a documentary and suddenly there's a Thomas Newman American Beauty soundtrack in my documentary, I hate that because I carry over the emotions I have from that film into the documentary. Usually it's a mismatch. It feels kind of cheap. It feels like, you know, they press the big button that says, feel this now, feel that now. And it's just clumsy. But someone like Tarantino can take pre-existing music and afterwards I associate it with his films, not with what they originally were made for. What about the two of you? How do you see that?
Same. I mean, I keep thinking about, I think it was Snatch by Guy Ritchie, where you have the fight scene. There's this big fight scene, very physical fight scene. And I think he said in an interview once he wanted to use Helter Skelter by the Beatles, but they couldn't afford that because that was like enormously expensive. So they came up with this Golden Brown, the song, very ballady, sort of sweet song, almost Simon and Garfunkel-like. And the contrast between these two, between what's happening in the fight scene and the music, works so well that it became famous in its own right. Now, he stole that from Tarantino, the master at this sort of stuff. But still, it works very well. On the completely other side of the equation, something that annoys me is that I watch a lot of silent films, and a lot of them are in public domain. But the soundtracks often are not in the public domain. So you have Ravel's Bolero for the 200th and 33rd time behind an action scene, a fighting scene, a love scene, an introduction of a character, because you don't have to pay for that. The music is free. And this is annoying to me because Silence, I think Alan wrote a very good piece about that on our website some time ago. Silence do need the music. So this is another way where overused music used again and again and again because of rights issues just gets my goat. At some point I'm like, yeah, can we figure out something apart from Ravel's Bolero, please?
I think that's the genius of Tarantino's use of music. He doesn't use overused music. He uses obscure songs and soundtracks that then become famous thanks to his films. There's, you know, the whistling theme from one of the Bernard Herrmann scores in Kill Bill number one, whenever you see Daryl Hannah's character as a nurse in a hospital. And this has become so famous, even though it's from an obscure late 1960s film that Herrmann scored. And of course, the same for the Morricone tunes that he uses. No one really remembers necessarily the scenes from those Morricone scores, but they become freshly associated with something. For instance, Uma Thurman trying to break out of the coffin in Kill Bill Part 2. And this theme, I don't think anyone remembers the actual scene from that 70s movie that it's from. I was thinking of two other directors that did that before Tarantino. For me, of course, the master of this is Woody Allen. Basically uses only jazz, sometimes classical tunes in his theme. And it's become kind of this library of tunes that were rediscovered thanks to Woody Allen's iconic films. And on the other side of that spectrum, of course, very much related to Woody Allen and his cinema is Ingmar Bergman and his use of classical music. There's almost no original score in any of their films, as far as I have seen so far. But of course, there's many, many classical tunes and jazz tunes and songs that became very well known thanks to their movies. So that those, I would say, are the original masters of that before Tarantino.
Yeah, and also, I don't know if you remember Fantasia, the Disney movie? That was built upon basically the Rhapsody in Blue by Gershwin. That's a pre-existing concerto. And they basically just animated a movie around the piece of music, right? It's almost like a proto MTV video clip. You can also look at it that way in terms of where the music is totally leading the action instead of the other way around.
Very much so. Okay, I think we've now basically shown the breadth of movie soundtracks, especially the movie soundtracks that we love, that we enjoy a lot, and that basically make a lot of films for us. Let's perhaps become more specific and talk about our favorite film composers or soundtrack styles, genres, or perhaps even specific films. I think each of us prepared a little package of music that kind of encapsulates how we feel about the best of movie soundtracks. Julie, do you perhaps want to start?
Yeah, there were so many, so I decided to restrict myself. But some of my favorites, Matt, you pointed this out, the Hisashi scores from the Ghibli universe, those have always been favorites of mine. But I decided to restrict myself, you know, I named silent movies and I can't always get access to the scores. So I restricted myself and I decided on two very specific jazz scores that belong to two very specific films. And the first I was already mentioned is Elevator to the Scaffold, and that's a Miles Davis score. Now that's pretty unique. I hope you all know who Miles Davis is, like, very famous jazz musician, composer, and trumpet player. And he, well, according to the story, they played this movie to him. They projected it on a big wall, gave him his instruments and put down a microphone and had him just improvise on the images. And that led to this really haunting, beautiful, beautiful jazz score in the Miles Davis vein. Now, these types of jazz scores have been overused in the 80s a lot, right? The sort of the series, what were they called? All the crappy silk stockings and everything suddenly had to have a tenor sax and that. It's not that kind of muck. This is an original score by an original, brilliant, brilliant composer. And it's a pretty good recording, which for jazz scores is also quite unique because some of these really great composers were recorded basically with a microphone in a club, which is just such a loss, I think. We lost so much of it. And this is an actual recording of actually Miles Davis and his quartet having a go at this film, which is wonderful. I suggest you see the film, but as I said before, I do suggest you go to YouTube and listen to the music all by itself because it's worth it. Now, the second score, this is going to make me very happy. This is a very, very famous Duke Ellington score for Anatomy of a Murder. Now, I love this film and I've already wrote up a very terse sort of defense of it a while ago. But the music, guys, the music, an actual Duke Ellington score. This has brass. It has a complete orchestra. This will blow your mind. It's so beautiful. It's so famous. It's on YouTube. Go look it up. Anatomy of a Murder original soundtrack. Listen to the whole suite. It's absolutely beautiful. And in the sense that this is real movie music, is that it is used in the film for the music that is playing in a bar in the film. So it's both an original soundtrack, like an orchestral score, which serves, as Matt pointed out earlier in the podcast, to introduce the characters and tell us a little bit about the characters, like the sexy femme and the strange old lawyer, who also is a jazz fan and plays jazz piano, by the way. Introduce the characters, but it's also used as almost source music, where it's the music playing in the club that they're in. And the same thing goes for Ascenseur, so Elevator to the Scaffold, where Florence, the protag, walks into a cafe and you hear the beautiful Miles Davis music turned up as if she's listening to it in the cafe, even though it's also a score that tells us something about the feelings of the character. So those are my sort of, that's my little package, but I could have gone on and on and on and on and on about this.
Absolutely. I think especially Elevated to the Gallows, I totally agree. And I think in some ways, when I think about that film, it is exactly Jeanne Moreau in the rain at night alone, walking while the Miles Davis soundtrack plays. And I think almost you could package that and it would be an encapsulation of the film. I mean, it's nominally a thriller, but I think in those scenes, the music and the mood and Jeanne Moreau's face make it into a tragedy, and any individual element alone wouldn't do that.
No, she's revealed in this film through the lighting, which is very novel. Again, see it for that. And through the way that she is looked at, again, she's in the rain, her hair is not perfect. She's not the perfect Jeanne Moreau that we're used to. But she's also revealed through the music. And this is sort of a way that her character, she has very few lines. This is the way her character is revealed through the score. It's really a great, beautiful, beautiful music. Yeah.
It's an amazing use of soundtrack. I've just recently seen it for the first time. And it's just, one shouldn't forget how revolutionary that scoring concept was at the time. I think it was probably Elmer Bernstein's Man with the Golden Arm that was one of the first real uses of jazz in film. And this one was such an iconic one as well. So definitely agree with that. Should I go on with my package at this point? Or?
Yeah, I think that sounds good.
So I also, of course, had difficulties figuring out how to limit myself to just a few. So I spoke about the big five before and I went through the five my favorite composers. And I discovered while I was putting together the list that very often these five composers had some kind of long-term relationship with a certain genre or a certain director. So we started with Morricone. So obviously one of my favorite instances of soundtracks is Morricone and Sergio Leone's Westerns. We've mentioned Once Upon a Time in the West. And I think Morricone shines with his style, his mixing of classical elements and then the most obscure instruments that he puts into his scores the most in that early Leone phase. And even though, of course, there's great collaborations with other directors like Dario Argento as well later on and Giuseppe Tornatore, I think the Leone ones are the ones that you go back to when you start with Morricone. I had the chance to discover more of his, thanks also to his recent passing. I really went into details with Morricone, discovering some of his other over 500 soundtracks that he wrote. So definitely that's my go-to when I think of Italian soundtrack composers. Another famous collaboration that I'm really fond of is Bernard Herrmann and Alfred Hitchcock's music. Herrmann, of course, went from working with Orson Welles in the beginning over Alfred Hitchcock to Martin Scorsese at the end. So he really touched upon all the greats in cinema. But I think the collaboration between Herrmann and Hitchcock is so grand and iconic. And apart from the obvious ones with Psycho and Vertigo, North by Northwest, I think I'm always intrigued by the small little bits that Bernard Herrmann writes. And I was thinking of The Trouble with Harry, for instance, when he uses an oboe to evoke a fall scene at the beginning of the movie. And it's simple, it's like 30 seconds and you've established something with the utmost simplicity. And I think that's the genius of Herrmann. He can be bold and dark and sparse. At the same time, he can be just very simple and lyrical in just a few seconds. He doesn't need the 4.5 minutes piece to build up the orchestra. It's just there. And that's what I find genius about him. Obviously, one of my first loves was Bond, James Bond. And of course, the person associated most to Bond scores is John Barry. And I would have to say one of his most iconic uses of music, apart from his rearrangement of the Bond theme, is On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the theme that he uses for that movie, and specifically also, of course, for the ski action, the Swiss ski chases. And I think that's some of the best music he's done, because he needed to elevate a movie that was thought to be a problematic movie with a new actor, George Lazenby, in the role of Bond. And it seems like Barry gave it his all. But of course, outside of Bond, everything about Barry in all his phases, the more symphonic later ones with Out of Africa or Dancing with Wolves, or his 70s experimental phases, I mean, they're all great. So I would say that's number three on my list. I already talked a bit about Jerry Goldsmith. That's a bit hard to pick one from his many scores. I was thinking most of The Omen. As a child, I was totally into that movie, and I discovered that the movie actually, again, isn't really that great. But what makes it stand out is the satanical chants and at the same time, the lyrical moments in Goldsmith's score. So I would definitely say anything that Goldsmith did in the realm of horror, of science fiction, of fantasy has touches of grandeur. And finally, obviously, for me, Williams and Spielberg is the association between composer and director that I find one of the most fruitful in cinema to this day. And it's almost impossible to pick one. I would probably go for E.T. and Jaws as kind of counterpoints to each other, to say that, I mean, if you listen to those two scores, you see what Williams is able to do, from really touching you deeply with E.T. I'm always in tears whenever I see the film again and again, thanks to his score and how it's built up to the utmost horror and Stravinsky-esque score in Jaws, which is, again, one of these themes, Matt, like you mentioned at the beginning. If you hum Jaws, if you hum the murder theme from Bernard Herrmann's Psycho, I mean, those are all, or the Bond theme, obviously, those are all the ones that you instantly recognize, but they're just as great when you go into the depth of the scores, to each individual cue. And that's what I love about those five composers. They're endlessly giving, if you go into, like I said before, their more obscure scores and into the actual, beyond the actual main themes. That's when those big five, to me, stand out.
Yeah, and just to go back to Barry a little bit, the interesting thing to me about him is that you always, when you look at the credits, you're like, oh, that's him too. Oh, that's him as well. And he's so good and so versatile that you don't even realize, oh, this is him. He's so versatile in terms of, and he's so humble in serving the movie rather than bringing his own sound. I really admire that about him.
Mm-hmm. Even though at the end, you know, people said Barry always sounds the same, but that was just in his last 10, 15 years when everything sounded a little bit like Out of Africa. There were always great themes, but of course he then had this symphonic Barry sound that was recognizable, but that's just the last bit of his extensive career.
Yeah, precisely. His earlier stuff, it's really so good.
I think it's a shame. I think there's some movie soundtrack composers that have a very iconic sound, but they have such an iconic sound that everything does sound the same, which doesn't change that their one or two perfect tunes are perfect. You know, I'm thinking of someone like Danny Elfman. I think he's got a couple of soundtracks that are absolutely fantastic for what they need to achieve. I'm thinking of something like Nightmare Before Christmas, but then also something like, obviously, Edward Scissorhands or the Batman movies that he did with Tim Burton. And I do think that they are perfect when you hear them the first couple of times, but then you start hearing more Danny Elfman soundtracks and you realize he's repeating himself, and he's repeating himself very quickly. I also have that with Carter Burwell, you know, who does the soundtracks for most, if not all, of the Coen Brothers movies. And I also think, for instance, his soundtrack for Fargo, I love it. It's, again, this kind of feeling of solitude that he conveys, plus this ominousness, this something is going to happen and it's not going to be good and you don't know yet what it is, like a snowstorm. It's fantastic. But then you listen to 4 or 5 Carter Burwell soundtracks and you start to realize a lot of them have very much the same feel, the same kind of harmonies, same kind of instrumentation. And I always think that's a bit disappointing, because for those first couple of soundtracks that are perfect, you wouldn't want anyone else. You just wish that these composers had a bit more of a range somehow.
Yeah, although I suppose they have to be very prolific and they're also on a schedule. And, you know, it's just easier to go like, oh, let me go back to this thing that I wrote 3 months ago, which was actually pretty good. And let's go from, I mean, it's also a job, right? I think it's an overruling passion in your life, but it's also a job. And in some instances, I'm sort of in two minds whether it's a sort of humility that they serve the film better instead of being very much their own voice. But in Elfman's case, I think he's just having too much fun. He's like, yeah, let's do this, but with theremins. Yay, you know. So it always ends up sounding like him. And, you know, sometimes for me, but this is really my personal thing, sometimes the soundtrack is just too servile to the movie, where you just have this sort of soundscape which goes throughout, and we just go like, yeah, it's very atmospheric, but it's too servile to the movie. And you can have your own voice in there as well, being you're the composer of the soundtrack. So mm-hmm. I'm a little bit in two minds.
For me, it has a lot to do also with the background of the composers. I find with Danny Elfman and his kind of coming from a rock background, from a band, and with Hans Zimmer coming from, for instance, the synthesizer background rather than a classical or a jazz background. I think for me, it always depends a little bit on that. I'm more into the people with either a classical training or the ones that came out of popular music into film, like John Barry did or Henry Mancini did, where they started off with jazzy or pop tunes in the 60s and then later on started to write for film. I always find they have almost the most interesting path into the world of soundtracks. Or, of course, the ones that are classically trained that just have a bigger range and are, I think, more able to write something that stands on its own as a piece that you can also listen to at a soundtrack concert, and it works perfectly well without the film as much as within the film. So I think my favorite composers either come from one or the other background, not necessarily the ones that are like Hans Zimmer, just doing that soundscape and the people who imitate that soundscape over and over again. That's not really interesting to me.
Julie, since you mentioned earlier on the whole thing about your own voice as a composer, I think that leads to one of my favorite uses of music in a film. And that's Jane Campion's The Piano, which has a soundtrack by Michael Nyman. Now, Michael Nyman, I think he became famous as a movie composer through his collaborations with Peter Greenaway, especially. He's also worked a lot with Michael Winterbottom, I think. I'm not sure he's worked with Jane Campion in any other films than The Piano, but I think in this one, it's definitely my favorite piece of Michael Nyman music used to very specific purpose. Obviously, you've got an orchestral soundtrack in The Piano, but more than that, you have a lot of piano music that's played by the main character, Ada, played by Holly Hunter. Ada is a silent protagonist in the sense that she does not speak. She has an internal voice, you have some voiceover, but mostly she does not speak to the other characters through words. But of course, that's wrong, because she does speak to the other characters through music. The piano tunes that she plays, they could be the character's own compositions. They are simple enough that they could come from this educated but probably not classically trained musician. And she uses the piano as a way of expressing herself, her longings, her yearnings, her anger, also her humor. I mean, there's a wonderful scene. You've got Harvey Keitel as a local guy who basically he gets hold of a piano and he then starts to trade her the piano key by key for, I would say, physical exchanges. It's very transactional at first. He wants to watch her. He wants to touch her. He wants to later on have her, also sexually. And there's this very early scene where he's just watching her while she's playing. And then suddenly he touches her. And her playing immediately changes from this very expressive piece of music that Michael Nyman wrote, that she, the character herself, is supposed to have written, to this gaudy Walzer by Strauss or someone, where it's very clearly, you know, this is hands off, mister. You're no longer hearing me. You're no longer getting me. This is what you get if you overstep my boundaries. And it's wonderful how the music is used to express very literally the character. It's really like dialogue by means of soundtrack. And I think that's wonderfully done in that film. So yeah, I think we've now all talked about some of our favorite examples of movie music, just individual examples that highlight what we love about movie music and what music can do that other things can't do. But obviously there are so many examples of fantastic movie music moments. And I think we can't end this podcast without mentioning just a couple of them, just to remind ourselves and our listeners of these great, great moments. Sam, do you perhaps want to start?
Yes, I will go back to an obvious score by Bernard Herrmann for my first example. I think in Vertigo, just watching the first half hour is almost like a guide to film music. There's James Stewart, who's asked to follow this woman played by Kim Novak in the film, and he trails her all across San Francisco in the movie. And the movie then takes us to different locations, and Bernard Herrmann has created this trailing music, this following this woman score that goes into all kinds of different moments, from the very first meeting when he sees her at a restaurant. And she appears kind of in a ghost-like fashion, also thanks to the music, apart from many other things. And then, of course, following her by car to different shops and museums. And at the end, her jumping into San Francisco Bay. And it's kind of everything film music can do is in that one sequence. So that would be the first one I would mention. Another one is Bond, the ski chase in Honor Match Secret Service. I think there is no better, brassier, and more exciting use of a main theme than in this. George Lazenby and Dinah Rigg skiing together in this scene, and of course the baddies following them, and the main theme just breaks out with this Moog synthesizer, and it's brassy, it's bassy, it's Barry at his very best. And the last one is again quite an obvious one, but I recently rewatched all the Star Wars movies with my niece, and just that dual sunset scene from Star Wars Episode 4 is incomparably great. And I think even for, you know, the 9-year-old girl, she understood that this was a fantastic, magical scene, not just with Luke and the sunset, but because the Force theme, of course, breaks out there for the very first time. And even though there are great other instances of that theme, and of course, many other Williams themes within the realm of Star Wars, to me, that is the strongest one, the boldest and most emotional one from the entire saga. So those would be kind of my three scenes that stood out when I was thinking of individual moments of score.
I've got a couple of possibly a bit weird choices here, and I have to admit that, you know, I made my notes, but now as I was talking to you, it's also my thoughts changed a bit. So if we talked again in one day's time or a week's time or a month's time, these would be completely different possibly. My first choice here is from The Shining. At the very beginning, when you've got the camera following the car going up to the Overlook Hotel, and you've got this synthesizer version of Dies Irae. I think it's composed in this case by Wendy Carlos and Rachel Elkind. And it's already the aerial shots. They're great, but they could be any kind of emotion almost. They could be grandiose. They could be epic. In this case, though, because of the synthesizer sound of this Dies Irae version, it sounds ominous, if not malevolent. It's really like, you know, this family is being watched by someone or something, and whatever is watching them does not want them anything good. It's this malevolence that is entirely created by the music that is just perfect. I like the rest of The Shining, but nothing for me is as perfect as that first moment with the music. The second one is Magnolia, and this is a moment that some people love, some people hate. I'm very much in the first camp. Magnolia very much uses a soundtrack by John Bryan, but also songs by Amy Mann, almost interchangeably. And I think very well, I think the tone of this film is just very much encapsulated in the music. But then there comes this moment when suddenly all of the characters in different places, in different situations, in different emotional states, but all extreme emotional states, they start to sing Amy Mann's Wise Up together. And that's where some people said, okay, I'm out of here. But for me, that was a perfect, audacious moment of using music, again, to express what the characters are feeling and to connect these characters. And it basically says, you don't like it? I don't care. This is what the movie needs at this moment. And my third example of a perfect movie music moment for me is Charlie Kaufman's Annalisa. In this film, you've got the main character who basically, everyone in the world, he sees them as the same face. He hears the same voice. He no longer can distinguish people. And there's this wonderful moment where at the very beginning of the film, he's in a taxi and on the radio, they're playing the Flower Duet from Lakme. You know, one of those pieces of music that is also omnipresent. I think British Airways used it for their ads for a long time. And even in this instance of him listening to a tune of music on the radio, he hears the Flower Duet with all the voices sung by Tom Noonan. And it is a complete mismatch. Tom Noonan is the guy who played the Tooth Fairy in Manhunter. He's not what you associate with such a beautiful, almost kitschy piece of music. And even there, you've got Charlie Kaufman using that moment of music, source music, to indicate the main character's inner world, which I thought was fantastic. Anyway, what about you, Julie?
I will not let this podcast close without mentioning Little Green Bag. I mean, that song was forgotten. I think that there no longer were any rights on it. But Reservoir Dogs, where the guys walk in their sort of cool, I suppose, similar suits, and you have Little Green Bag. I mean, this is one of those, I shouldn't use the word iconic anymore because it's so overused, but this is one of those moments I think everybody remembers. And there are a couple of those in Tarantino that I have to mention. The Girl You'll Be a Woman Soon with Uma Thurman, turning on the tape, the music coming in really loudly in scene and her going completely bonkers on the music and also on whatever it is that she stuffed in her nose. You have Casablanca, anyone? Play it again, Sam. You must remember this. Come on, I can't leave you alone without mentioning those. And a personal one, there is a movie by Del Toro, which is Pan's Labyrinth, which has this little lullaby in it. And it's a story of this girl. And in the end, without spoiling anything, the lullaby is repeated and sang. And it always, always makes me cry. I just can't help myself. It's so beautiful and it's so sad and so tragic and so infuriating. That is also one of those moments where everything just comes together, the film, the music, where I just flow over, right? So those I wanted to mention before we end this. I cannot let you go without mentioning those.
Obviously, I think all of us, we could continue mentioning fantastic movie music moments, fantastic needle drops for the next several hours. And I know that with myself, I basically now want to go and watch and rewatch all of those films. So thank you both very much for this journey through movie music. It's been very enjoyable. Thank you, as always, to our listeners. Have a very good time, and we'll be back with another damn fine cup of culture. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.